So we're going to start at chapter 4 and verse 12 on page 504 of this book. God's people, Israel, are living in a kingdom under King Xerxes, and his wife is called Esther. She's a young Jewess, and there are two other characters in the court of the king. There's Mordecai, who's a Jew and trusts God, and there's a man called Haman who hates God and wants to do away with his people. And at this stage in the story, it's looking pretty black, very black. An edict's gone out to have the Jews killed in a few months' time. And that will include Esther and Mordecai. And God's work will stop if that happens. So things are really black and desperate, and we need to find out what happens next. So Esther chapter 4, starting at verse 12. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this? Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go gather all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall facing the entrance. When he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her and held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. Then the king asked, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom it will be given you." "If it pleases the king," replied Esther, "let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I have prepared for him." "Bring Haman at once," the king said, "so that we may do what Esther asks." So the king and Haman went to the banquet Esther had prepared. As they were drinking wine, the king asked Esther, "What now is your petition? It will be given you. And what is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted." Esther replied, "My petition and my request is this. If the king regards me with favour, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfil my request, let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet I will prepare for them. Then I will answer the king's question." Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. Calling together his friends and Zeresh, his wife, Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honoured him and how he had elevated him above all the nobles and officials. "And that's not all," Haman added. "I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave, and she has invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction, as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate." His wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Have a gallows built, 75 feet high, and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go with the king to the dinner and be happy." This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the gallows built. That night the king could not sleep, so he ordered the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. It was found recorded there that Mordecai had exposed Bigthanah and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. "What honour and recognition has Mordecai received for this?" the king asked. "Nothing has been done for him," his attendants answered. The king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows he had erected for him. His attendants answered, "Haman is standing in the court. Bring him in," the king ordered. When Haman entered, the king asked him, "What should be done for the man the king delights to honour?" Now Haman thought to himself, "Who is there that the king would rather honour than me?" So he answered the king, "For the man the king delights to honour, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn, and a horse the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on its head. Then let the robe and the horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man the king delights to honour, and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, "This is what is done for the man the king delights to honour." "Go at once," the king commanded Haman. "Get the robe and the horse, and do just as you have suggested. For Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate, do not neglect anything you have recommended." So Haman got the robe and the horse. He robed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city streets, proclaiming before him, "This is what is done for the man the king delights to honour." Afterwards, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman rushed home with his head covered in grief and told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that happened to him. His advisers and his wife Zeresh said to him, "Since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin." While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman away to the banquet Esther had prepared. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther, and as they were drinking wine on that second day, the king asked again, "Queen Esther, what is your petition? It will be given to you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom it will be granted." Then Queen Esther answered, "If I have found favour with you, O king, and if it pleases your majesty, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold for destruction and slaughter and annihilation. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet, because no such distress would justify disturbing the king." King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, "Who is he? Where is the man who has dared to do such a thing?" Esther said, "The adversary and enemy is this vile Haman." Then Haman was terrified before the king and queen. The king got up in a rage, left his wine, and went out into the palace garden. But Haman, realizing that the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. Just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. The king exclaimed, "Will he even molest the queen while she is with me in the house?" As soon as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs standing by the king, said, "A gallows 75 feet high stands by Haman's house. He has had it made for Mordecai, who spoke up to help the king." The king said, "Hang him on it." So they hanged Haman on the gallows he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's fury subsided.
Is God in charge? And what is he doing? Esther gives us some answers to that. Is God in charge, and what is he doing in the world? What's he doing in our lives? As Adrian mentioned, we've been introduced already to the main characters in the book of Esther, in what Mark said a couple of weeks ago. There's Xerxes, he's the party-loving king. There's Haman, who's the ambitious prime minister. There's Esther, who's the Jewish exile, living in Susa, wins a beauty contest, inverted commas, becomes queen. And so far, her identity as a Jew is secret. And then there's Mordecai, the cousin, the guardian of Esther. He's foiled a plot to assassinate the king, but he hasn't got recognition for that. He annoys Haman intensely, so much so that Haman wants to get rid of not just Mordecai, but of all the Jews in all the land of Persia. And you'll remember from a couple of weeks ago, perhaps, that Haman got the king to agree that on a certain day, he threw the dice, and on a certain day, 11 months on from that moment, that there will be a time when anyone could rise up and could kill, could annihilate the Jews anywhere in the whole empire. That was the cliffhanger we ended on last time, and obviously we saw in the reading today how that worked out. We've had an answer to the question, will God's people be wiped out? Well, today all those threads weave together. The turning point is really chapter 4 into 5 in terms of Esther. The kind of literary turning point in the book is chapter 6. They're the central kind of places in which everything turns. You remember at the end of chapter 4 and into chapter 5, Esther is beginning to change. She's beginning to think, I am part of God's plan here and I need to act. She says that she's going to go into the king, even though she may be killed. This was common practice. If she went into the king's presence without being asked, she knew that. But she says, "I'm going to go for it. If I perish, I perish." But she asks the people to fast, and presumably to fast and to pray for God to be with her as she does that. Don't know whether she has a strategy, or whether she's just taking fearful, semi-random steps and seeing what God will do. But she stands in the inner court, maybe shaking, maybe trembling, I don't know. But scared, because she could die that moment. That could be the moment that she is decreed to be executed. But she stands there, the king's pleased to see her. He extends the scepter, she's able to come in, he offers half the kingdom. That was a kind of a standard cultural expression then. May not literally be true that he would give away half the kingdom, but it's saying really whatever you want in general, then you can have it. And maybe still she's not got a strategy, so she says, well, let's have a banquet and we'll have the man Haman there, and maybe something can happen. And he comes and he wines and he dines and he enjoys himself. And things in a way seem to be getting worse, because Esther's had her banquet, but Haman's still around, and Haman is very happy as he goes home. And he goes home and he boasts about how popular and successful he is. The only little spoiler is, as he goes, he sees Mordecai and he's really annoyed again. Talks to his wife, talks to his friends and advisors who say build a gallows just by his house. Massive gallows, about the size of a house. Builds this gallows outside his house. No Mid-Sussex District Council to say, you haven't got planning permission for that. He's the Prime Minister, so he just builds one. And it was some construction that, what a thing to have an executing thing outside your house. Probably some sort of pole on which the person would be impaled eventually. And so things still don't look that good. Esther's exercising faith, yeah. But history hasn't turned, has it, at this point? But chapter 6, verse 1, is when things start to really turn. Esther's on the move, but now we can see that the course of history is changing. As a relatively trivial thing happens, that night the king could not sleep. Anybody here have trouble sleeping? Any of the children up the front have trouble sleeping? Well, I'll put my hand up. I have trouble sleeping sometimes. There's all kinds of things you can do. Get up and have a milky drink, doesn't work. Get up and watch the television, definitely doesn't work. Read a book, play a game on the computer, that doesn't work either. How about reading history? That might put some of you to sleep, mightn't it? And that's what the king chooses to do. He ordered a book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought and read for him. Now, I don't know how many scrolls there were, and I don't know for how long he had to have this read to him in order that he could fall asleep. But I doubt the whole history of all of his empire was going to be read out at that moment. But somehow they read the bit about Mordecai and how he'd foiled a plot to assassinate the king, how he'd told one of the king's advisors, or one of the king's eunuchs, and they'd found out about it, and those people had been brought to justice. And the king says, has he been honoured? And no, he hadn't been honoured. And what is really a very humorous kind of turn of events, the king's thinking about that and says, who's in the court? And who should be in the court but Haman, or Haman? I don't know whether Adrian's right or my history is right of saying Haman all of my years, but I don't know. Anyway, this bloke, beginning with H, he's in the court, and the king says, what should we do to someone who honours the king? And as we're told, there was this kind of thought bubble in his head. Oh, it's me, what can we do for me? And I think some of you are even kind of laughing a little bit as it was being read, because it is so funny that he thinks it's going to be him who's honoured, and it's Mordecai. He devises this great scheme. Let's parade this man through the city. He's got the royal robe on to show that he's really honoured by the king. He's got a special horse with the royal crest on it to show that he's honoured by the king. And he has to lead Mordecai through. And there's a sense expressed in verse 13 by the wife and the advisers. And they say, since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against it. you will surely come to ruin. She's a helpful wife, isn't she? You will surely come to ruin. Chapter 7 is a second banquet. Things seem to be turning, but I don't know whether Esther yet has a plan. But verse 3, she comes out with it. She's asked again, I think for the third time, what do you want? And she says, what's happening? And she identifies herself with God's people. You see that in verse 3. Queen Esther answered, if I found favor with you, O king, and if it pleases your majesty, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. You see, she connects herself with God's people. She says, I'm in trouble as well as God's people are in trouble. Now, of course, in real terms, it was highly, highly unlikely that Esther was going to get killed on this time in 11 months' time. Very unlikely. She's the king's wife. No one knows she's a Jew. But at this moment, she really does step out and she says, I'm with God's people. They're under threat. King, can you do something about it? It's a great moment for Esther. We were looking rather unfavorably at how she begins the book. And I think that's fair to do that. Maybe it was a surprise to some of you. But at this moment, things really turn. She's been brave enough to enter the king's presence. And now she comes out and she says, I'm with God's people and I'm pleading with you to protect them. That's chapter 7. And as chapter 7 unfolds, the king is furious, doesn't know what to do. Esther identifies Haman as the man who's at the head of this plot, but of course King Xerxes has also signed off on this law, so he's perhaps pondering on what to do, so he goes outside, pacing around outside. Haman's kind of stuck. If he stays in, that's wrong because you're not supposed to be alone with one of the king's women. If he goes out, he's not sure what's going to happen because the king's so furious. If he leaves the room, perhaps everyone will think he's escaping. So he doesn't know what to do, so he begs with Esther. Not sure whether he falls on the couch or him being on the couch is part of him begging Esther, but somehow, that moment the king comes back in, there's Haman and he's begging Esther. The great Haman, the prime minister, the proud man, here he is begging a Jewess. Remember Mordecai, he wouldn't bow down to Haman, would he? And now here's Haman bowing down to a Jewish lady. And the king, he's relieved because he's now got a pretext to get rid of Haman. He assumes, maybe he doesn't really think this, but maybe he does. But he uses a pretext to say, you're molesting my wife, and finds a way to execute Haman on the very gallows that he'd erected for Mordecai. Esther, in chapter 10, is given the estate. Let's just see the changing fortunes there. Esther is given the estate of Haman. Mordecai is given the signet ring. He's made the prime minister in place of Haman. The edict still stands about everyone can rise up and can annihilate the Jews. So Xerxes is not so sure what to do, but Mordecai and Esther, they do put together a new edict, a new law. You can't repeal the old law, but you can make a new law. So they made a new law that the Jews could defend themselves. And that is sent out with great urgency. Not random acts of violence by the Jews are now permitted, but they are allowed on that day to assemble, to protect themselves, and to defend their families. And that, we're told, is the history of a celebration called Purim, as we get into chapter 9 and into 10. It's an ironic name, really, Purim, for a festival of the Jews. It was eventually to be a two-day festival because there were 2 days in which they were able to defend themselves. Purim is from the word for casting the lot, throwing the dice. And that was the means that was used to decide the day that the Jews were going to be slaughtered, but it's the name they give to their festival. And then finally, chapter 10, we see the role of Mordecai. He's a prime minister who protects the Jews, and it seems that he also turns Xerxes' kingdom into a powerful one. He imposed tribute throughout the empire, and all his acts of power and might, that's King Xerxes even, together with a full account of the greatness of Mordecai, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Media and Persia? So it seems that he becomes a king who could be described now as not a playboy, but great and powerful. Such a turnaround. A weak king in some ways becomes a great king, a powerful king protecting the Jews. A wicked prime minister hanged. A slave girl becomes a queen and a savior for her people. The Jews who were under threat are now actually feared by everyone. What do we learn from this? Just a few things. Overall, God is at work. But in particular, God is at work in the details of history, often unnoticed. God works in the minute detail of people's lives. His providence, his power, it controls all events. We can trace absolutely no coincidences to any other source than God himself. I put a posh shirt on this morning, I think. It's quite a nice shirt. And I needed some cufflinks for it because there's no buttons. So I looked out some cufflinks and I got a certain set of cufflinks out and thought, oh, I don't know if I should wear those today because it's a churchy thing. And maybe you three guys at the front, can you tell me what I've got on my cufflinks from this distance? A bit closer? Dice. Yeah, I got some dice on my cufflinks. So I thought I wouldn't wear them, but then I thought, how appropriate to wear dice on your cufflinks when you're preaching about Esther. Because it was about throwing the dice or casting lots in some other way that determined the day on which God's people could be annihilated. And it's the name for the festival that they inaugurate to celebrate their deliverance. And you know what? Every throw of every dice on every gambling table anywhere in the world, the outcome's determined by God. Now, that doesn't mean you need to go and become a gambler and pray a lot. But it does mean that from the most trivial events to the most traumatic, dramatic events, God is completely in control. And when you kind of whiz through Esther, you get that sense there's so many things happening that might just not have happened in that way. But because God is in control, it did happen that way. Why did Vashti the queen get in a mood on that particular day? And when the king wanted a new queen, and it was suggested this process for him, why did he go with it? Well, maybe we could understand that. But of all the girls in all the provinces, of all the nationalities, why does Esther get selected as the queen? Was she the most beautiful girl in the world? Well, maybe she was pretty, says that. But surely someone else could have been picked and could have become queen. But Esther is chosen. And why did Mordecai hear about a plot to kill the king? And why did he tell, but he didn't get recognized straight away? That's a bit unusual. And when Haman threw the dice or cast lots in some other way or had some other method, why did it choose 11 months on for the day when the Jews could be annihilated? And on that crucial day, when Esther walks into the outer court and the king looks up, why wasn't he in a mood? Why wasn't he impetuous? Why didn't he have a hangover? Why didn't he say, get lost, get out of my presence? Why did he say, come in? And then why did he have a sleepless night? And of all the scrolls that he could have read, just imagine his kind of massive bedroom with four-poster bed and all sorts of gold everywhere. And there's just scrolls scattered all around the floor because the people have all been woken up. They're all in their pajamas and dressing gowns and stuff and having to find some scroll. The king wants to read some scrolls. And what one should we find? And he's throwing another box everywhere. Why? Why do they get to the scroll that talks about Mordecai from 4 years previously? What a kind of random number. 4 years previously, they happen to read that bit. And why does Haman arrive on the worst possible day he could arrive into the king's court feeling chuffed with himself? Why does he arrive at that moment? Could have arrived an hour earlier, an hour later, on a different day. But he arrives just at that moment. And why? Why does he fall over on the couch or whatever happens just at the moment that the king comes back in? Why? Because God is at work. And not just in the big stories here. God is at work. And as we said last time, God's name is not mentioned in the book of Esther, but God is the director. God is the producer. Sometimes we only get to know the actors' names in films. Of course, there are famous directors and there are famous producers, but often it's the actors that become the most famous, isn't it? And it's a bit like this here. God is like the director, the producer. He's orchestrating the whole thing here, but his name is not mentioned, and in a way he's unseen. Unless you inquire who is behind all this? Who is working to save his people? Everything from the dice to the scrolls to the timing of every event. Who is working? And the Jews reading these stories and us reading these stories are supposed to say, God. We know that it's God who's working. God works in the big saving works, in the Exodus, in the exile. God works in the ordinary events of your life. He rescues us from many dangers. He helps us through everything. There are no surprises to God. There are no random events. Nothing falls that wasn't supposed to fall. Nothing stays up that wasn't supposed to stay up. From the most massive world events to the flicking of a coin and the throwing of a dice, God is in control. And we just need to ask ourselves this morning, and you perhaps need to ask people over coffee this morning, do you trust in the Lord of history? Do you think God's really in control? So I'll tell you what we do if we don't think God's in control. There's two fundamental things we do. One is fear, and one is trying to fix it. That's what we do when we think God's not in control. For one thing, we just fear. We just worry. We think, oh, I don't know whether this is going to happen. I don't know how this is going to turn out. I don't know if these events are going to work out all right. We fear. We fear the future. We fear an unknown future. We fear what might happen. And we show that perhaps we don't really believe God's in control. The other thing we try and do is fix, isn't it? We try and fix everything. We think, well, I know kind of God's sort of in control in a sort of fatherly way. And I know he's there, but I really do need to make sure I fix everything up just right. And that I have a plan and a strategy. And I've thought through all the contingencies. Now, of course, as Esther shows, we need to do stuff. We need to work in the grain of God's providence. Of course we need to do stuff. But we're not responsible for the outcomes. God is. We're just responsible to be faithful. So when you've really got a big view of God being totally in charge, you won't fear and you won't take the responsibility to fix everything. Do you trust the Lord of history? God works, God is at work with imperfect people, secondly, with imperfect people who are growing in faith. Esther, Mordecai, they seem to start badly. But as they end, they're a powerful queen, they're a powerful prime minister. Look at chapter 9, verse 29. So Queen Esther, daughter of Abihail, along with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm this second letter concerning Purim. Isn't that extraordinary? She's called Queen Esther. She starts the book just being called plain Esther. And she's writing with full authority a law. And it's a law about Purim, a Jewish festival. Imperfect people who are growing in faith. They eventually save the nation and they start to work for the good of God's people, as we saw in chapter 10. I love the fact that they don't really seem to have much of a plan, because I don't really think they do. I love the fact that they start the book downtrodden and secretive. And I love the fact that they make progress, don't you? They make progress. Doesn't that give you hope? Maybe you can't tell people at school or at work that you're a Christian because you're fearful. Maybe you know that you're not really acting in faith, that you hide your trust in Christ. Esther and Mordecai give you hope. Maybe this morning there's a call to you to say, just start moving in faith. Maybe you're living in fear of something or someone. And maybe you need to realize that God can still use you as you start to walk in steps of faith. Will you do that? Will you start to exercise faith as Esther and Mordecai use, and to recognize that imperfect people growing in faith can be used in God's purposes? She grows in faith, Esther, and she grows in faithfulness. She exercises faith because she says, I'm going to do this even though I don't know the outcome. I'm going to trust the God of providence. She exercises faithfulness in that she starts to identify with God's people and work for the good of God's people. Are you growing? You may not be a great strategist. You may not have a plan. You may not know what the outcome is for various things that you're going to do in your life, but you know that God's in control. You know that God's on the throne, and you want to start living by faith and not in fear. You're prepared to start taking risks. You're prepared to do something where you're not quite sure what the outcome would be. Something for God. You do something for God. You act in a particular way. You talk to somebody about Christ. You take a stand on an issue, and you don't quite know what the outcome will be, but you say, like Esther, if I die, I die. If there's a bad outcome, there's a bad outcome, but I'm going to start living by faith and not in fear. God's at work with imperfect people who are growing in faith. God's at work to judge and to save. I think we've worked out here that the potential really is for God's people to be completely wiped out. And of course that would be an end to God's promises, wouldn't it? God has promises, has made promises, his purposes to bless his people. And of course he's promised to bless the whole world through his people, through the descendants of Abraham. So here in this book of Esther, this book that doesn't mention the name of God, really the whole purposes of God in the whole of history are at stake, aren't they? This is a key moment. If the Jews are wiped out, where does the Saviour come from? There's nowhere. So this is a key moment of battle, of spiritual battle, in the kind of cosmic war of God against his enemies. This is a key moment, and God is at work to judge and to save. God does work here, doesn't he, in severe judgment against Haman and against his enemies. He works to bless those who bless God's people. Xerxes' kingdom is blessed. But he also works to curse those who curse his people. And we need to remember this morning that God is always acting to judge and to save. Throughout the history of the Bible, God is acting both to judge and to save. He judges his enemies. He saves his people. No one's going to stop the tidal power of Haman or the king's edict except for God. God must judge that. No one else is going to save God's people except for God, and he'll do that. So God is always acting to judge and to save. And don't we see that so perfectly at the cross? No one else could save us. No one else could deliver you from your greatest enemies. Last Sunday morning we were thinking about our enemies. Sin, our enemy. Our enemy, the devil. Death, the consequence of our sin and the accusations of the devil. Those enemies couldn't be defeated any other way. God acts at the cross of Jesus to judge our enemies. Our sin is judged, the devil and his accusations are defeated, and death itself is defeated. That's what happens, judgment at the cross. And at the same time as he is judging Christ, God is saving us. Just like at the same time here, as he is judging Haman and all those who are rising up against the Jews were saved. Just in that same way, at the cross, as Jesus is punished, people like us are rescued. So here we are at the cross. And we need to wake up because it's the most important thing, isn't it? That at the cross, Jesus is judged so we can be saved. God works for judgment and salvation. He's doing that throughout history. And because of the cross, we know that ultimately God will save us from all people who stand against us, from all our enemies. All of those who laugh at Christians, all of those who put Christians in prison, all of those will one day face the responsibility for that. But much more importantly, we're saved against the responsibility, the guilt of our sin. And we're saved from the accusations of the devil. And we're saved from the power of death, from eternal death. Those are the enemies that are defeated. And we have been saved at the cross. And we will be saved, and we will know that to be true. So God is at work to judge and to save. And it's worth asking ourselves this morning, can you see that at the cross? Yes, God is on the throne and in charge, but can you see that at the cross God is judging and saving? Have you understood that yet? Because that's fundamental to having a relationship with this God who's on the throne. Do you understand the cross, the judgment of God, the salvation of God through Jesus? And you know the wonderful thing is that when God's at work, he transforms our mood. He turns us from mourning to joy. God is the great table turner. He's the great game changer. There's Haman, proud man, begging a Jewess. Here's Mordecai, whose life is under threat, eventually becoming the prime minister. And especially, here's God's people. Look at chapter 4, verse 3. Think of their mood then. In every province to which the edict and the order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. Contrast that with chapter 8 and verses 16 and 17. For the Jews, it was a time of happiness and joy, gladness and honor. In every province, see the echo of that other verse? In every province, and in every city, wherever the edict of the king went, there was joy and gladness among the Jews with fasting and celebration. Not fasting that went with weeping and wailing, but feasting and celebration. Not the fasting and the weeping and wailing, but the feasting and the celebration. And then, which is really funny, and many people of other nationalities became Jews because fear of the Jews had seized them. It's like revival time. They're feasting, they're celebrating, they're not fasting, weeping and wailing, and loads of people want to become Jews because it's the great thing to be. As God's people are saved and as they start to rejoice, loads of people want to join them. Isn't that fascinating? So God transforms our mood, and we need to reflect that, and you never know what God will do as we really start to praise him. If you've understood the cross, if you've understood that this great sovereign God has judged your sin in Christ and defeated all your enemies, your mood is transformed. It changes completely. It's what people talk about when they testify to becoming Christians. They say, this was my mood. I had moments of kind of losing myself in pleasure and wealth and distraction, but ultimately I wasn't satisfied. I wasn't happy. But now in Christ, I am deep down, satisfied and happy and joyful. And that's what God does for us. He transforms our mood from mourning to joy. Are you a Christian this morning? Many of you are. Are you joyful? Has your mood been transformed? Does it continue to be transformed? Now, of course, there are times to mourn, and there are times to be upset over all kinds of things that happen in our lives and to mourn our sin. But as a fundamental disposition, are you joyful? That's what we're called to be. That's what we're supposed to be. That's what we can be because of the cross. Are you joyful? Because you know what? When God's people are really joyful, everybody wants to join. When God's people are really praising him because he's completely transformed their mood, it's attractive. Because it's real joy. Because God is genuinely on the move and we testify to it. So, we're going to be a joyful people. Don't know what it looks like, because I'm not sure I've entirely seen it. But are we going to be a joyful people this morning, through this week? Are we going to be a joyful person tomorrow morning? It's early, it's dark, it's probably raining, and we're going off to work. Are we going to be a joyful person who says, my mood's been transformed? I'm a bit grumpy because it's a bit cold and it's a bit wet. But fundamentally, my mood's been transformed. I'm not under condemnation anymore. The God who's on the throne, he's controlling every single event of my life. And do you know what? They're all weaving, all the threads, all the confusing things that are happening. They're all weaving me towards heaven because God's defeated my enemies, and I'll know that and I'll feel that and I'll experience that. So I'm cheerful, even though I missed the bus. Are you going to be joyful this coming week? Because who knows what God will do when God's people are really joyful like that.